I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Like many of you, I was horrified to learn that Salman Rushdie had been brutally stabbed and seriously injured last Friday as he was about to speak at the Chautauqua Institution in New York. He was rushed to the hospital, and word is he will recover from his wounds. While we don't know the motive of the attacker, Rushdie has lived under a death threat since 1989 after the former supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini, ordered a fatwa because of Rushdie's novel, The Satanic Verses. Rushdie then went into hiding for 9 years, which he chronicled in his memoir, Joseph Anton, his pseudonym that was a mashup of Anton Chekhov and Joseph Conrad. Since then, he has lived openly, traveling for speeches, book tours, and public appearances. In fact, he was a guest on Radio Times 7 times and never had a bodyguard. He was one of my favorite guests, charming, brilliant, fearless, and funny. We're going to talk about Salman Rushdie's writing and the importance of free expression, but first we'll play a portion of my 2013 interview about his memoir. As we certainly know about you, you lived under the threat of a death sentence for about 9 years.
Yeah, or even more, really. But it was, a lot of people, particularly in England, began to feel that because I hadn't been killed, that nobody had been trying to kill me, that it was all exaggerated. But the fact is, first of all, that it wasn't only I who was threatened. The publishers of the novel, its translators, etc., were under threat in many countries, and there were attacks.
In fact, a translator was killed.
The Japanese translator, Professor Igarashi, was murdered at his college late one night when he was working late. The Italian translator was seriously attacked and was very lucky to survive. And my Norwegian publisher, William Nygaard, was shot 3 times in the back and survived by a miracle. And as you know, there were attacks on bookstores around the world, including here in the United States. Cody's bookstore in Berkeley was pipe bombed. There were firebombs in other places, too. It was a very, very real attack.
Did you feel, though, during that time, did you have not regret so much, but a sense of responsibility? As you said, people paid, in certain cases, almost with his life.
Well, you can't help feeling, that if friends and colleagues of yours are being threatened and attacked, you can't help feeling responsible. But I remember very well when William Nygaard, my Norwegian publisher, had recovered sufficiently from the wounds for me to be able to speak to him on the phone. The first thing he said to me was, "This is not your fault." He said, "I'm a perfectly grown-up person. I knew what I was doing when I published your book. I'm very proud to be the publisher." And then in true heroic publisher style, he said, "By the way, we've just ordered a very large reprint." And I thought, to say that from your hospital bed when you've got 3 bullet holes in you is a genuinely courageous act.
Do you think the critics, did they understand the book or did they misunderstand the book?
Well, many people didn't read it. Many people were just pointed in a certain direction by extremist priests and just believed what they were being told and went that way. There are 1 or 2 cases I quote in the book of people much later who had been involved in the protests coming up to me and saying that they had since then had actually read the book and they couldn't see what the fuss was about, even though they had been the people making the fuss. So that was frustrating. I think what's fair to say is that the relatively short part of the Satanic Verses that deals with this material in a dream sequence is, if you like, a kind of dissident view of the birth of a religion, because I'm not a religious person. So I'm looking at religion and the phenomenon of revelation from the point of view of someone who's skeptical about it. And I guess there are people who don't like that.
But you also seem to say that Khomeini was using this fatwa for his own political purposes Iran.
I don't think that's even really in dispute anymore. This was not long after Iran's Iraq war had ended in a kind of debacle. And the revolution was probably in more trouble than it's ever been, since it happened. And he was looking for a way to rally the troops, and it was just as my bad luck to be Khomeini's last stand.
Right. A sort of a diversion for him.
A diversion for him in a way of kind of re-energizing the faithful. And that, unfortunately, turned out to be me.
I got the feeling that, and I don't want to go too much out on a limb on this, is that this fatwa was the beginning of extremist acts. I'm not saying it led to 9/11, but yeah. but there might be a circuitous path from this fatwa to something like 9/11.
I think there's pretty much a straight line. You know, actually, I mean, one of the things that I try and show in the book is how that line goes. You know, that something which began as what seemed like a bizarre, marginal, kind of one-off, weird thing, you know, which didn't seem to be symbolic of any larger project, you know, how we gradually can see how that project enlarged, you know, and I think I came to think that what happened to me was a kind of prologue, you know, and yes, the 9/11 attack was the main event, if you like, you know, but you can, I think, see the growth of that kind of malevolent, kind of medievalist assault using modern technology. You know, how it grew during those years. Many other people were attacked all over the world, and then climaxing in this terrible event in America.
I saw a quote about, and this is about the satanic verses, and about you saying, you say, it's not an evil book, and I'm a good person.
Yeah. Yeah, this is you know, there's a section in the memoir which I call the trap of wanting to be loved. And I think the problem is we're all guilty of that. We all want people to think well of us. We all want to be the good guy. And certainly when this trouble started, there was a bit of me which thought, if I could just explain it to people, they will understand that they've made a mistake, you know, and then we can all be reasonable and shake hands and get on with our day. And that was
naive, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a delusion. And it was, I think, in a way helpful to me to lose that idea that if I just say the right thing, everybody will love me. And I thought, well, these people who aren't going to love me, well, you know, it's okay because I'm not that wild about them either.
if you knew a fatwa was a possibility, would you write the satanic verses any differently?
And I think the answer is yes, because I'm actually very proud of that novel. I mean, I think it is very close to being the best novel I ever wrote. I mean, it's certainly, in my view, one of the best. And what I like is that now that the fuss has died down, is that finally a lot of people are reading it, you know, just as a novel instead of as a hot potato. And a lot of people like it, you know. And my view is I don't see why the opinion of the people who like it matters less than the opinion of the people who didn't read it and didn't like it, you know. So I think maybe it's time that the people who like the book have their turn.
You write at the very end of the book, and it seems like when the fatwa is lifted or you feel safe enough to live in the world, you're no longer Joseph Anton. You're now Salman Rushdie.
Yes, I was very happy.
Did it feel like I'm sort of shedding this identity?
I hated having that. I mean, one of the reasons I made it the title of the book is just to dramatize for people how weird it is to be asked to give up your name.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very weird thing. It's one thing, you know, there are writers who want pseudonyms and so on and like to, but I was never a writer of that kind. But in your personal life, to be asked for security reasons to give up your own name, it's a bizarre thing. Yeah. And I thought it would, in a way, dramatize the bizarreness of those years if that was the title. Joseph Anton, a memoir, it ends up being me, you know. It's
especially
odd.
Written in the third person.
Yeah. So the day I could lay him to rest was a happy day. Yeah.
Are you still friends with your guards or some of the guards that you write about?
Some of them, yes. In fact, when we had the book publication for the memoir in England, I invited a lot of them, and a lot of them came.
Hmm.
You know, and now they because they were off duty, they could drink, which they couldn't back then.
Did they call you Joe?
They tried very hard. They almost did, actually. I saw it beginning to slip out of their minds, but they controlled themselves.
I saw something that you said this summer that really interested me. It was that actually at the Edinburgh International Book Festival, you said, I do think that one of the characteristics of our age is the growth of this culture of offendedness. It has to do with the rise of identity politics, whether you're invited to define your identity quite narrowly, you know, Western, Islamic, whatever it might be. But I was interested in this culture of offendedness.
I mean, I think it's a very worrying thing that people seem to feel that their identity is best expressed by the things they are against, you know, the things that upset them or annoy them or allegedly insult or offend them, you know. And because, of course, if you were to use that really as a guiding principle, everything offends somebody.
Of course.
You know, and it means there would be no books in the bookstores, there'd be no movies in the movie theaters, you know, nobody would be able to speak, you know. And in any kind of genuinely free society, we just deal with the fact that people are going to say things, write things, you know, make movies that we don't like, you know, and you just have to deal with it. But now it seems as if there's a project amongst many groups to try and prevent the expression of things that they don't like, you know, and that's, of course, in a country which prides itself on the First Amendment, that's a big problem.
Do you think it also, I mean, as you were talking about talking that way, I was thinking about just how the Twitterverse, for instance, is just alive with people slamming other people. You get to be anonymous in certain ways. It allows people to be more offended offensive.
Yeah, I do think the anonymity question is quite a problem because you're quite right. It allows people to be rude, discourteous, in a way that they would not be if their name was known and they were sitting in the room with you. And I worry that it's bringing up generation after generation of people who think it's okay to be viciously rude without any excuse or justification, just because you feel like it, because you're trolling somebody. On the other hand, of course, there are people who defend the anonymity by saying that, particularly in countries where there are authoritarian regimes or whatever, that the anonymity allows the public to protest.
Sure. You know, look at Iran a couple of years ago.
Iran, Egypt, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a thorny question. But there's no doubt that sometimes there's an advantage in the anonymity. But sometimes, yes, it leads to kind of colossal rudeness of a kind that's worrying.
Does anything offend you?
Oh, lots of things offend me. You know, the novels of Dan Brown. but I think he should probably live.
And that's the difference, right?
That's the difference, yeah.
But do you think it's come down to that?
No, I mean, I think it's, you know, I hope that some of this tide, I mean, these things are cyclical, you know. And I know that, for instance, a lot of the people who protested against the Satanic Verses 25 years ago now publicly say that they regret it, that they thought it was a mistake. You know, some of them think it's a mistake for tactical reasons, which is they said, oh, it just made him more famous and sold more of his books.
And there's some truth to that, isn't there?
There is some truth to that. And some of them feel it was a mistake because they've, in a way, accepted the free speech argument, which is that if they get to say what they want to say, people who disagree with them must also be allowed to say what they want to say.
One of the arguments is that some people have more free speech than others. And by that, I mean, if you're Dan Brown or perhaps Salman Rushdie, chances are you have a bigger audience for your speech.
No question. No question. But I mean, I think here is one of the things that the First Amendment really gets right. It's better to allow unpleasant things to be said than to prevent difficult things from being expressed. You know, so the rule is everything's allowed. And I mean, I must say it's worrying when you see some of the ugliness that is expressed in the name of free speech. You know, but the problem is, how do you start silencing it? Who decides where the limit is? And if you're going to err in one direction or the other, I think to err in the direction of too much freedom is better than erring in the direction of too little.
Salman Rushdie in 2013 on his memoir, Joseph Anton, coming up, the importance of free expression, the importance of Salman Rushdie. This is Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The first time I interviewed Salman Rushdie nearly 20 years ago, yes, I have laryngitis, I was shocked to find him sitting in our very public lobby, casually reading the newspaper. There was no bodyguard, no call for extra security, no disguises. Rushdie has lived under a death threat for more than 30 years for his novel, The Satanic Verses. And as we heard, while the book has been burned and banned, has led to attacks and riots and the murder of his Japanese translator, Rushdie had been safe until last Friday when he was stabbed multiple times at a festival in New York. While his injuries are serious, he is expected to recover. So today in Radio Times, we talk about Rushdie's contributions, his profound belief in the value of free expression, and the threats that writers face here and abroad. We have two guests who have joined us. Randy Boyd. Boya Goda is a novelist, professor of English at the University of Toronto, also the former president of Penn, that's P-E-N, Canada. And Randy Boya Goda, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And also with us, Summer Lopez. She is Chief Program Officer for Free Expression Programs at PEN America. And Summer Lopez, nice to have you with us from Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. You know, and I'll start with you, Randy. It's such a bitter irony that Salman Rushdie was at Chautauqua to talk about the United States as a haven for writers and for artists who face persecution. And there he was nearly murdered on a stage ready to give that talk.
Well, and I think, you know, it speaks to something you'd said even in your introduction just now, Marty, about the fact that in a sense, he wasn't safe until this past Friday, right? This could have happened at any given point. It could have happened in the lobby of your studio. It could have happened on his visit to Toronto. It could have happened in any number of ways. The point, I think, is that Salman Rushdie made the decision when he came out of hiding about 10 years after the declaration of the fatwa to integrate freedom of movement with freedom of expression. And as you said, and I certainly experienced it in the events I've done with him over the years, he's made it very clear he doesn't want a heavy security presence. So I know that, you know, a lot of the coverage of the event has been very critical of the good folks over at Chautauqua for not having a stronger security presence there. And it goes against the kind of the general ethos of the place. But also Rushdie himself would have probably balked at the idea because he was you know, that committed in his person and on the page to freedom, freedom of movement and freedom of expression. So yeah, absolutely, it was a shocking event and very sad and terrible that it happened. But it's not like it was I think many of us, including myself, thought of it as something that resumed. And it's clearly something that has been continuous. And his response to it has been to be continuously open and in the public.
Be very consistent about it. Summer, I'm reading a quote here actually from PEN America. Quote, "We can think of no comparable incident of a public violent attack on a literary writer on American soil." It's pretty shocking.
It really is. And, you know, I think that, however, you know, I think it's notable that they were about to have this conversation about offering asylum to writers under threat and the U.S. as a safe haven, because while it remains that, we have seen other threats to people within the United States, and we have seen, you know, in other cases where it's much clearly, you know, where governments are actually, you know, reaching beyond their borders to intimidate and threaten and harass and in some places, you know, attempt to harm writers and others who have spoken up against them. You know, there's the case of a writer here in New York, Masih Alinejad, Iranian-American, who was the target of an alleged Tehran-backed kidnapping plot last year. The U.S. government charged four Iranians in that case, and just recently there was a man with a loaded rifle arrested near her home here in Brooklyn. So, you know, this is an increasing, I think, trend that we're seeing, and something that we at Penn have been paying attention to and are very alarmed about, because I think it's really, it's essential, you know, that we ensure the U.S. remains and other democratic countries remain places where writers and others in exile who have been targeted for their speech and expression can be safe and continue their work.
Well, in fact, she had a piece in the Washington Post this morning, Opinion, Life in a Safe House, Why I Sympathize with Salman Rushdie, and talked about what it's like to live in hiding, which he did for almost 10 years. To you, Randy, I mean, are we living in an increasingly unsafe world for writers, do you think?
Well, I think there's two scales for that, right? Just building what Summer just described there with that Iranian-American writer. You know, we certainly see these things abroad. People like Raif Badawi, the Saudi blogger, jailed for 10 years for falling afoul of that government's laws about speech and free expression. He was lashed in prison 50 times, recently released, but he's in a 10-year travel ban now, separated from his family, his wife and children in Canada. There's the comedian Zarganar in Myanmar, who has been arrested many times, most recently in April 2021, and more recently released by the regime there. So there's versions like that that are hard and difficult and real, and really put writers, put their lives at direct mortal risk. And then there's the phenomenon that, you know, Rushdie was describing in that interview that you ran to start the show today about the culture of offendedness, the suppression of books not liked, right? There's this kind of two-scale phenomenon where often related to identity politics, and I had a little bit about this in the article I recently wrote for The Atlantic about the Rushdie situation. You know, there's that version of things which occupies a lot of, I think, internal publishing and literary culture conversation, and then there's the work of people like Summer and others and people in pen centers around the world trying to draw attention to less known writers who are more directly facing, you know, more than being canceled or having their books pulped, but, you know, having their lives destroyed, really.
Well, and picking up on that, and Summer, going back to you then, do you see this attack on Salman Rushdie as an attack on all writers, or was, do you think there's just something sort of unique about, first of all, his willingness to live so publicly, but also the fact that he had this fatwa, this death sentence on his head for more than 30 years?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, of course, it is a unique case, but I also do think it is emblematic, you know, and I think there we document the detentions of writers around the world every year in our Freedom to Write Index. You know, we've seen an increase over the past couple of years. We documented that there were 277 writers and public intellectuals detained around the world during 2021. That's up from 238 two years prior. So, we definitely see that writers are often targeted for their expression. They're often also at the forefront of resistance movements, you know, from Myanmar to Belarus. Writers and artists have been a part of pushing back against authoritarianism, and they're targeted as a result. And I think, you know, there's a reason that authoritarians and extremists of all sorts target writers, because stories are powerful and they offer people a vision of a different world. They remind people that they themselves have the power to imagine something different and to bring that to reality. And so, you know, for those who want to keep people in the cage of tyranny, it's important to quash that. And we're definitely, you know, we're seeing that happen, I think, around the world.
Let me go back to you, Randy, and I mentioned the fact that he's been a guest on this show for many of his novels. I will also confess, I found his writing kind of hard going.
Yeah.
Not easy, not kind of that summer beach read that we can just kind of breeze through. I mean, I love talking to him, but I didn't always frankly connect with his writing. How should we think about his novels, his writing?
Well, first, thank you for saying that out loud.
I know.
You know, I've long thought of Satanic Verses, and Salman said a little bit about this in that interview with you, as, you know, the most purchased, least read book in history.
Exactly.
You know, even yesterday here on campus at the University of Toronto, I was chatting with a colleague who kind of sheepishly pointed out she's had it on her shelf for years, probably dating back to 89, and it never cracked it open. It's a difficult book. Salman Rushdie himself, you know, thinks of it as one of his finest. And, you know, for those of us that have written about him, taught him over the years, it's a very good, it's a remarkable novel. But it is a hard place to begin. You know, if readers are interested in getting into Rushdie's work, there are two books that I would recommend instead. I would recommend Midnight's Children, the novel that brought him to prominence in 1981, a kind of first-person exploration of India's independence from Great Britain, and then in turn subsequently partition. It's the 75th anniversary, so there's something timely about that. I suspect we'd be talking about Midnight's Children with Salman Rushdie right now were it not for the events at Chautauqua last week. That's a very good book. If you like, for example, 100 Years of Solitude, Gabriel Garcia Marquez's superb novel, it's along those lines, a kind of world historical reimagining of experience through a very ordinary person's telling of that story. And if you're not maybe a major literary fiction reader, but you still want to read Rushdie, then I would turn to something like Harun and the Sea of Stories, which was a young adult or a children's novel that he wrote in the mid-90s, 94, I think. And it was his attempt to make sense of the fatwa and of the experience of the fatwa for his son, Zafar. It's lovely. Both books have a lot of wordplay. They're working in various different traditions, right? The Ayatollah in Harun and the Sea of Stories is called the Shah of Blah. So, you know, there's a kind of a playfulness to that. It's very accessible. But I would, you know, don't just buy Satanic Verses and then never open it, or only, you know, don't get very far into it. Midnight's Children would be where to start if you're a serious reader already. Or Harun and the Sea of Stories, I would say almost anyone and everyone of all ages could read.
And Randy, I mean, I don't want to get lost. I don't want to talk about him in the past tense either. He's very funny.
He's hilarious. Absolutely. He's a very, I mean, the Shah of Blah, right? He's exactly. a very, very funny writer. The novel that I mentioned in that Atlantic piece was The Ground Beneath Her Feet, which came out in 99. And, you know, one of the two main characters is a magic realist reimagining of Elvis Presley if he grew up in post-war Bombay and heard about rock and roll from U.S. Marines visiting the port. And then it plays from there, and it's kind of wild and crazy and absolutely very funny. His kind of love of wordplay that stretches across north and south, east and west, pop culture and deep literary, religious, and historical narratives and stories. I mean, no one can do it like him. Really, it's almost Joycean in a sense, the kind of delight he takes in playing with words. I mean, that's why I imagine at Chautauqua he would have mentioned one of the characters from Ground Beneath Her Feet. The other main character is a diva named Veena, who grows up in upstate New York in part, and herself, Rushdie writes about how she moves around the country at a certain point as a kind of activist celebrity delivering Chautauquas. So I know if he had been there, he probably would have played on that if he had not been attacked, and perhaps just as importantly, if he'd been given the chance to talk about his writing, not just about the importance of being free to write. That's one of the frustrations I think he's faced over the years.
And he we're talking about is Salman Rushdie, and that's Randy Boyagoda, also with us, Summer Lopez, talking about his writing, his contributions to the literary world, to the cultural world, to conversation, I would say, as well, and also the threats that writers around the world face also here at home as well. You can join our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Summer, you mentioned a number of writers who, you know, live under just dire threats around the world, but we're also living in a country here where book banning has become very, very popular. I mean, this is, you know, we've been seeing those school board meetings where someone is offended by something and doesn't want someone else to read it. If we, does banning books lead to threats to authors? I don't want to make too bold a claim there.
No, I understand, but I think there is a line, right? I mean, I think it goes to this sort of questions of the broader culture of free expression that we think about, and you know, we see a lot of similarities, you know, in terms of this point that, you know, many of the critics never read Satanic Verses. You know, we see that in so many of the book ban cases too. People are responding to what they're told about the book or to one piece of it they've seen without any context of the story as a whole. You know, I think that goes exactly to the point Salman made in that interview about people who, if they actually read the book, might take a different view. You know, what we have documented over the past year is an incredible increase in the scale and virulence of book banning attempts across the U.S. This used to be a thing that, you know, kind of came across PEN America's radar a couple of times a year. We put out a statement. Usually a school district would reverse their stance pretty quickly because nobody likes to be called a book banner. But over the past year, I mean, we documented between July of 2021 and March 31st of this year, over 1,500 book bans that had occurred in 86 wow. school districts. Wow. We're going to be putting out an update to that next month, and it's going to be significant. You know, that is unlike anything really we've seen in recent memory.
Well, let me get Martha to join our conversation, and then we'll certainly pick up on that as well. And Martha, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty, and thank you to your guests. I have to say I appreciate so much the work that PEN America has been doing in this space. I am a school librarian. I have been fighting attempts to ban books in my school library, and in the process, I have been labeled by book banners as a sex offender.
Oh,
I was horrified by what happened to Mr. Rushdie last week, and I think many of us, when we see these headlines, we are horrified, but we're viewing them from a distance. I'd like to know what your guests would advise the average person listening to your broadcast. What can they do on the ground in their community to fight back? And I'll start. Join uniteagainstbookbans.org. It's a coalition. PEN America is involved by the ALA. Everyone can go and sign up today.
Fair enough. Martha, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Randy, you want to respond to her comment there?
I do. I'm very sorry to hear about that. And, you know, to kind of respond directly to Martha's question, read as much as you can. Keep on reading. I think the awfulness of the book banning, the effect beyond free expression into the kind of larger public and into individual people is the kind of creation of a fragility, a shared fragility, an inability to deal with difference, to deal with difficulty, and this kind of reactiveness. And I think probably many of the people listening to this show, I'm sure all three of us, where did we find our capacities from that? Not from reading about free expression, but from reading literature, from encountering lives not our own, and trying to make sense of decisions that are made that we disagree with. That those capacities have so much importance, and without free expression, we don't have a free movement of our imaginations. So I would just say, read as much as you can, and encourage others to do the same.
We're almost up on a break here, but Summer, just a quick worry, concern that I have is I can understand a parent not wanting their particular child to read a particular book. We'll just, you know, sort of leave it out there. But to prevent other children or other parents letting their children read that book, that is where it gets so worrisome.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's where I think, you know, we do see a similarity between what we've seen in cases like Rushdie's and cases like with these individuals' books. Of course, everybody has a right to be offended themselves, to express that, to critique, to argue back. But you don't have a right to silence that expression, and you don't have a right to prevent other people from being able to read or hear and make their own assessments. And I think, you know, that is so much of what we're seeing in these cases as well. If something offends me, it must be removed, destroyed, silenced for everybody. And I also really want to thank Martha for what she's doing and say how sorry I am for what you're experiencing. It's something we're seeing, unfortunately, everywhere.
Yeah, librarians on the front lines. We are going to take that very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Summer Lopez. She's Chief Program Officer for Free Expression Programs at PEN America. Randy Boyagoda is a novelist, professor of English at the University of Toronto, former president of PEN Canada. We've been talking about Salman Rushdie, what happened to him on Friday, also the importance of free expression. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with our guests about the violent attack on Salman Rushdie last Friday at Chautauqua and the importance of defending free expression. And again, our guests are Randy Boyagoda and Summer Lopez. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call, as Martha did. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Randy, let me go back to you. I know that you have interviewed Salman Rushdie as well. Would you say he is an absolutist when it comes to free expression?
You know, I would say so. I think about as I think he'd made that point, I think, in that interview that you were mentioning earlier with respect to allowing better to have more freedom and more offense than less of both, in a sense, right? Yeah. But, you know, to be honest, I haven't spoken to him. I've interviewed him, you know, several times. We've had, you know, we know each other a little bit personally. We haven't spoken that much about free expression. And part of the reason for that is because he doesn't really want to. You know, he came to Toronto in 2017 to mark the 25th anniversary of his coming to Canada in 1992 for a PEN Canada event. It was his first major public appearance after the fatwa. It was hosted by Margaret Atwood and others on stage. He came back in 2017 to mark that. And his one request to me, two requests going in, one were not to have a heavy security presence. And then the second was, he said, you know, can we talk about something other than the fatwa? Can we talk about something other than what happened at Satanic Verses? And he kind of got a little testy with me, to be honest. And he kind of said, you know, I still made a passing reference to it before we went on stage. And he said, you know, I've written six other novels since then. You know, like there was more that he wanted to talk about. So, you know, his his commitment is undeniable in his work and in his very body, as we all know now. But I think his interest is, yes, talking about it when needed, but when it's not needed, talk about his work.
Well, Margaret Atwood, speaking of Margaret Atwood, had a piece in, what am I looking at here? I am looking at The Guardian, actually, about what happened to Salman Rushdie, where she says, the right to freedom of expression does not include the right to defame, to lie maliciously, and to damagingly about provable facts, to issue death threats, or to advocate murder. Those should be punished by law. And, you know, as we all know, Summer Lopez, you know, it's a tricky thing finding that middle ground. I'm thinking of Alex Jones and, you know, his abuse and torture of these families in Connecticut and obviously on trial for defamation. But nonetheless, you know, finding that middle ground, or that shaky middle ground, perhaps.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, of course, free expression has never been completely without limits, right? As Margaret notes, there are aspects of it that are considered illegal. There are those restrictions. But I think it's really important that we keep those restrictions narrow, because I think it's a very slippery slope, and the dangers of empowering government to start making those decisions, to make decisions about what's offensive or what's true, is very dangerous. And we see that play out in other countries quite often, you know, and with laws against disinformation, they're almost always used against journalists, writers, activists. And you know, we know that that's sort of how that happens. So, you know, I think but they're obviously significantly complicated questions around, for example, the social media platforms.
Sure.
You know, I think there's also dangers in overly empowering corporations to make those decisions. But they also have every right to decide what sort of culture they want to facilitate on their platforms. And we know that we do a lot of work on online abuse as well, and its impact on writers and journalists in particular. And it can be very silencing. So disinformation and online harassment are significant threats to freedom of expression, but we have to figure out how to counter them in ways that don't also infringe on people's right to speak.
Yeah. And then, Randy, of course, there's the self-censorship, where people just are afraid to speak out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a very troubling thing. In other words, not even just there's the question of speaking out, and there's also the question, and I say this as a novelist, the question of what you're willing to do on the page, right? And the worries are very practical. Not only are they the high and grave concerns that are kind of made manifest by what happened to Salman Rushdie this past Friday, but even at the level of getting a book published at this point, getting past sensitivity readers and publishing houses. I saw some coverage over the weekend with Rushdie reflecting that he wouldn't be sure that in our current publishing climate, Satanic Verses would have made it through in 2022 the way it did in 1988 or 89 with his Norwegian publisher from his hospital bed asking for more copies. And so, yeah, there's a kind of curtailing of the imagination that certainly can happen, I think, with writers kind of alongside readers and then in the larger publishing industry. I think that's a real problem.
Well, here's a letter that Rushdie and a whole bunch of other writers wrote to Harper's. This is 2 years ago, actually, July 7th, 2020, a letter on justice and open debate. And one of the things they say, the free exchange of information and ideas, the lifeblood of a liberal society, is daily becoming more constricted. While we have come to expect this on the radical right, censoriousness is also spreading more widely in our culture. And intolerance of opposing views, a vogue for public shaming and ostracism, and the tendency to dissolve complex policy issues in a blinding moral certainty. Really looking at the left, Summer, and at the right.
You know, I think there is definitely, we have seen an increased inclination from all ends of the spectrum to sort of step away from the precepts of defending free speech and free expression. And I don't want to make false equivalencies.
Sure.
The use of sort of the power of government or legislation to enforce censorship, which we've also seen, you know, significant. We actually just put out a new report today on what we called educational gag orders that have been introduced around the country to restrict what can be discussed and taught in classrooms. That's, you know, that's sort of at the top level of what we worry about in terms of violations of freedom of expression when it comes from government. But that's not all that we worry about, right? We also worry about fostering a culture of freedom of expression. And, you know, I think that is where I have concerns as well about, you know, what we see on all sides of the spectrum. I think, you know, oftentimes it's coming on the left from very legitimate concerns about racism, hateful language, extremist language. But again, we have to sort of approach that in a way that doesn't fall back on censorship or silencing or, you know, restrictions on expression as a solution. I think there's, you know, there's a younger generation as well that has often really heard free speech invoked only to defend hateful speech and has sort of lost touch with the fact that there's no space for protest or social movements or progress without freedom of expression. And so, you know, I think we have to be very thoughtful about that. There's, you know, there's, I think, an alarming tendency often to equate speech with violence, but that opens up the possibility that it's acceptable to respond to speech with violence. And, you know, that is something we obviously cannot brook. That's not to say that speech can't be hurtful and harmful, and we sure have to address and acknowledge that. And we have to take steps to address the fact that the freedom of speech has not always been enjoyed equitably by people in this country by any means. But that doesn't mean that we step away from defending it, because without it, our democracy is kind of lost.
Well, I'm thinking about someone, Rushi, talking about, you know, people being offended and even saying, well, how about the people that like what it is they're reading? Don't they have a voice at the table as well? But also, Randy, somehow equating words with violence. And I've heard that. I've seen that.
Well, you know, in my time as president of Penn Canada, I think, you know, for us, the red line was incitement to violence. Right. That would be the kind of the up until that point, I guess you could say we were very much committed to untrammeled free speech. But beyond that, no. And, you know, when you think about the situation for Rushdie, and even, you know, that Harper's letter that you mentioned, which certainly was controversial when it was published, you know, it speaks to what Summer was saying about the people who the signatories of that letter were very prominent, were indeed speaking from positions of security, frankly, right, relative to a comedian in Myanmar or a blogger in Saudi Arabia, let's say. What I remember actually very specifically from when Rushdie was last in Toronto in 2017, I asked him where threats to speech were coming from, and he said his big worry was on the left. In other words, you know, as troubling as book banning is, it's not a surprise in some ways, right? The fact that it's expanding makes it even more troubling. But his willingness, and this is what it makes Salman Rushdie exemplary, given the audience he was speaking to, his willingness to say the problem is from the left, which certainly didn't land, you know, kind of to applause at a Toronto literary event, tells us that, you know, his willingness to call out problems everywhere he sees them is something that we should all sort of keep in mind. And then, meanwhile, cultivate the capacity to deal with that, to be able to respond to it with more than, again, a kind of a violent, suppressive reaction.
Well, and let me quote one more sentence from this letter. We need to preserve the possibility of good faith disagreement without dire professional consequences. If we don't defend the very thing on which our work depends, we shouldn't expect the public or the state to defend it for us. Just to kind of leave that out there. Let me just read an email from Beverly. She says, another response to book banning is book buying. As an example, mm-hmm. when I read that Art Spiegelman's Mouse had been banned, I immediately ordered it for my grandson. So many of us did that they had to print more copies. And it is sort of weird, Summer, and I don't know if this is going to be true or not, but I wonder whether there will be more interest in the satanic verses as a result of this attack. But oftentimes when books are attacked, people become interested and book sales go up.
It is often true, you know, and I think that's always kind of the mistake that people make in attempting to ban things. You draw attention to it, people want to read it. That said, you know, we find that is much more true for people like Art Spiegelman and Salman Rushdie, who are known names. A lot of the books, you know, that we are seeing targeted are written by LGBTQ authors, Black and Brown authors, and people of color, and they are, you know, not having that experience necessarily. And they are also losing other opportunities. You know, they're losing invitations to speak. They're losing invitations to schools. You know, they know that publishers might think twice before taking up their next book. And so the impact is very real. And I do think people sometimes have the impression that it can just be a good thing for the author if they're banned, but it's really not the case. And it's also not what the authors want to be known for, just like Salman, right? They want to be known for the work, not for being a banned author. So I really reiterate the advice to read the books, buy the books, that are being banned, not just the famous ones, but the ones maybe you haven't heard about. You know, and in the book ban case too, I would just also add, you know, go to your school board meetings, write an op-ed in your local paper, because this is a minority of people who are having an outsized influence, and people need to hear. The vast majority of people oppose book banning on principle, and those people need to have their voices heard too.
Fair enough. Randy, you're joining us from Canada. We've been focusing largely on the United States here. Are you looking and having the same kinds of issues related to book bans and arguments about what people can and can't read?
No, I don't think it's happening in Canada at nearly the same scale or intensity as in the United States. You know, probably when it comes to free speech, this won't surprise anyone, the two kind of more recent major issues for us had to do with anti-government protests associated with the quote-unquote convoys that descended upon Ottawa in January.
Oh, yeah.
And the ways in which the government and the media responded to those. And, you know, again, there was an interesting reaction, frankly, from sensible liberal respondents suggesting that, again, free expression and free movement were kind of being curtailed on in a sense, almost both, not both sides, that's stupid, but there was more here than simply thugs shutting down the Capitol, right? The question is, could we have had a more healthy democratic life where they would have found other channels and ways to express their protest without having to do that? And then, you know, I am speaking to you from the campus of the University of Toronto, where until just this past year, Jordan Peterson was a faculty member, not an active teaching faculty member for a while. But certainly, you know, his presence here in Canada, again, not nearly as much as in the United States where everything is magnified, was also, I think, a challenge. I was chatting with a colleague about this yesterday, about what it meant for people not to protest Peterson, but how do you deal with the people who wanted to hear from him, who themselves weren't radical? And, you know, is our rejecting their capacity to hear him radicalizing them inadvertently almost? And so those would be maybe the more immediate things that come to mind from my vantage.
Let me just make a segue to you somewhere, because I did want to talk about Adnan Khashoggi, who was murdered, dismembered at our understanding is that at the orders of Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. President Biden was just there recently. And I sort of hate to end the show on such an important issue, but how should we factor that into our conversation?
You know, I think the Khashoggi case is absolutely a piece of this. You know, I think that the sort of civil society community, the human rights community, responded to that with such fervor because it was such a sort of brazen act, you know, well, just way beyond the lines of anything that other governments had sort of attempted previously. And you know, the idea that Mohammed bin Salman could get away with it without significant, you know, cost to him, we really felt that was going to set a very alarming precedent. And I think that's been the case. You know, there just wasn't the sort of response and accountability. It's not to say that nothing has happened. You know, the U.S. government has taken steps, especially under the Biden administration. But, you know, it's been very, I think, frustrating to continue to see the fact that human rights don't make it to the top of the foreign policy priority list in cases like this, where somebody, you know, it's a strategic ally. But the implications of that are severe. And I think, you know, I think that has sort of laid the groundwork for some of the other extraterritorial attacks that we have increasingly seen over the past few years.
Well, we have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Time. Summer Lopez, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And she's Chief Program Officer for Free Expression Programs at PEN America. Randy Boyagoda, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
My pleasure.
And he's a novelist, professor of English at the University of Toronto, and former president of PEN Canada. And we began our conversation with my 2013 interview with Salman Rushdie about his memoir, Joseph Anton. To replay this hour and many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.